So, this is the last of a series of four. I preached on prayer, on the Bible, on worship, and today on heaven and hell. Thanks, Ruth. In 30 years of Christian life, it suddenly occurred to me that I'd never heard a proper decent sermon fundamentally about hell. It gets tucked in here and there. Never even had a home group or a seminar talking about hell. And as I contemplated this, probably a silly thing to do, I felt challenged by God to preach on it. So here we go today. The one benefit of this, that I'm not going to struggle for your attention. This is the fourth part of a little mini sermon series that I've been doing on God's open secrets. The whole idea of God's open secrets is that they're things that are very clear and open, but somehow we miss them. And so this is the fourth and final part of this little sermon series. I always like to start with these mystery pictures. This one's a little bit more obvious. Anybody know what that's a picture of? The sun, very good. It's not a snapshot of hell. It's just simply a snapshot of the sun, the surface of the sun, taken by some very clever telescopes, and they've actually merged three pictures together. If you're very observant, you'll notice a little dot down here at the bottom. That's not an accident. That is Earth to the same scale. That is the sun. That is Earth. And at this scale, Earth would actually be not that close because we get fried very quickly. It would be somewhere down about Sainsbury's, about a kilometre away, just under a kilometre away. You get the idea about this. The sun is powerful. It somewhat feels like a hellish place, but there it is, shining through the window. It's a huge nuclear explosion that stays within 0.1% of its output. Otherwise, we get too hot or too cold. We'd either freeze or burn up to a crisp. It would also change the weather if it just changed by a fraction of a percent. This thing is very finely balanced and is completely supplying all of our energy needs, basically. It gets our plants growing, it feeds our animals, it gives us light, it keeps the planet the right temperature, it drives the whole weather system. It's hugely powerful, and yet it's so finely balanced. The Christians claim God put that there and balanced it. Either these claims are very, very true or very, very mad. There is no middle ground. You cannot have a partly created sunshine. Either God created that, and that's Earth. Oh, sorry, back one. And that is Earth down there, which, by the way, it takes 35 hours to fly around in a jet plane. So that's quite big in itself. And that is sun. And this is the kind of God we're talking about that created that. Oh, and by the way, several billion other ones. That is the kind of God that the Christians are declaring. Either it's true or it's completely and utterly mad. One of the two. There is no middle ground. Rolling back to my last sermon, I just do this as kind of helping to recap. I did it on worship. Worship is powerful. Worship is the real power of Christians. It puts God in the right place. It centers us on God. It brings us back to what it's all about, God, our source of strength, our refuge, our everything. He is our real power. True faith looks beyond our circumstances directly to our God. It steps forward in praise and worship, even before there is any evidence our God will answer. And God releases his power when we do this, when we step forward in faith. When we do this, it brings great delight to our God. Are heaven and hell real? You know, most people are quite comfortable if you start talking about heaven, you know, maybe it's just a fanciful idea, but most people won't respond very strongly. Start talking about hell and people get a little bit more uncomfortable in their seats. They might start voicing opinions and fighting back at you. Tell people you believe in Satan and they think you are completely and utterly mad. They'll get really opinionated, they'll have very strong reactions. It is really the taboo of our life, of our era. If you go back 100 years, people would preach on it. People wouldn't respond in the same way. But today, if you start talking about Satan, you really get an opinion from people. in the way that you would really not get from any other subject. I find it quite interesting, because if I say to someone, oh, I met an alien and, you know, the alien told me X, Y, and Z, or aliens exist, people aren't so opinionated. But if I start talking about Satan and the way he's attacking me or orchestrating something, people get very opinionated one way or the other. I think that tells me something about the very subject itself. If it's aliens and people are quite neutral about it, well, you can just think that for yourself, that's fine. But if you start talking about hell and Satan, people get very strongly opinionated, even if they don't think it's true. Doesn't that tell you something about it? We don't believe in all that spiritual stuff. Horoscopes are still incredibly popular. People still read them. Superstitions are widely revered. The 13th, Friday the 13th. Breaking mirrors, walking under ladders, all sorts of little superstitions. People just won't do because, well, maybe. People use lucky charms, fluffy dice in cars, all sorts of funny things, but they still do them. The supernatural pervades our entertainment. The cult followings are widespread. If you just go and look on the top films that are being shown, nearly all of them have some sort of element of either supernatural, very heavily intertwined with it, or horror that is based on real deep evil, something very dark. It is incredibly popular. Yet these people don't believe in any spiritual stuff, yet they're fascinated with it. All of the gaming out there, again, heavily, heavily coloured by the supernatural and by very dark evil. Even Star Wars, a light-hearted film, The Force. Frozen, the magical powers. Harry Potter. Netflix, the latest, greatest one, is The Witcher. If ever I saw anything pervaded with occult-type level stuff, it's really dark. There's a fascination with it. There's an interest in it by these very people that claim no interest whatsoever in it. Even in the way that we talk as Christians, we often wish people good luck. It's a small, subtle thing, but what are you actually doing? You're relying on luck. Much better to try and wish someone a good blessing, but it's so heavily in our culture, so intertwined, so deep in. This is the World Economic Forum in Davos, 2019, that's in the middle of Switzerland. The FT describes this meeting as a meeting together of global leaders, corporate titans, academics, and thinkers. So all the best in the world, they meet together, and they try and figure out, and in this particular place, they're trying to work out inequality. They're trying to make the world a fairer place. And so they've got a panel of experts, all sorts of people. And this guy talking, this is just a snippet from it, is called Rutger Bergman. And he's a historian. And he's just observing something from the whole conference, not just from this particular thing. And here's just a short clip of what he has observed.
This is my first time at Davos. And I find it quite a bewildering experience, to be honest. I mean, 1,500 private jets have flown in here to hear Sir David Attenborough speak about, you know, how we're wrecking the planet. And, I mean, I hear people talk in the language of participation and justice and equality and transparency. But then, I mean, almost no one raises the real issue of tax avoidance, right? And of the rich just not paying their fair share. I mean, it feels like I'm at a firefighters conference and no one's allowed to speak about water, right? There was only one panel, actually.
Well, we've had two. You're the second of our panels.
There was only one panel.
Let's go there.
One panel hidden away in the media center that was actually about tax avoidance. Yeah. I was one of the 15 participants. So something needs to change here.
So he's just making an observation that is blatantly obvious. Why aren't they engaging with it? Why aren't they doing something about this? Sometimes these things require us to change and it can be uncomfortable. Is evil real? When I say evil here, I'm not just talking about things that aren't very nice. I'm talking about things that are really, truly malicious or vicious, utterly selfish, perverse, those sorts of things. True, dark evil. Is it real? Do we see it around us, in our world around us? Is pain real? Do I really need to ask that? Is suffering real? All the world beliefs, and none, if you don't believe in it, these pose real problems for them. The real question for all of them is, why do these exist? What purpose do they serve? This is what the Bible has to say on the subject. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome or understood it. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was not made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who trusted in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. Before the universe was created, there was God. Was all. God. That was everything. More than all. Far more than all. God then created a universe. He created light. He didn't create the darkness. He created the light. He created a universe where light existed, but also where darkness could exist. That was the difference between where it was just God and where he created a universe where darkness could exist. He didn't create the darkness. He didn't create the places in the universe where there was an absence of God. He created a universe capable of having places where there was no God. Why did he do this? For freedom. If he had just created a universe where there was just God, there would be no choice. If God turned up in this room today, you wouldn't have any doubt who he was. Look at the sun he created. Look at the stars he created. There would be no choice. God created a universe filled with light, but allowed places of darkness. Philosophers love to label God as the one who created evil. God made a creation where evil could emerge and exist from free will, the light and the dark. God also remained somewhat hidden so that choice was truly free will. Interestingly, if you look through history, the price of freedom is always high. And I think that very thing reflects God's original creation story. The price of true freedom is high. And even God is prepared to pay that price. And he did through Jesus. We will never fully understand the suffering Jesus went through. It wasn't just the physical. There was a very deep spiritual cost that Jesus went through. And I believe he bears the scars of it to this day. God paid a price for our true freedom to choose or not choose him. That is our freedom, is to choose to accept God or to reject him. Either he created that universe or the whole thing is a load of rubbish. There is no middle ground. This is a message directly to Christians as to how real this universe is and really where the struggle is. Finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. The devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, and against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. God created a physical world that we can see, taste, test, hear, everything we experience. Science is concerned with the physical world. God also created another world, a spiritual world. And we are given some insight into this in the Bible. I'm not going to read all of these things. There's quite a few verses here. Please do go away and study them, study their context, study what they're saying, what their message is. I'm just going to summarize them. Here, Daniel, this is in the Old Testament, has spent 21 days praying to God and got no answer. Suddenly, an angel turns up And the angel says, the reason I am not here more directly was that I got held up by a demon. And the demon stopped me, and Michael, another angel, had to come and help me. We're given a small insight into this spiritual domain, this spiritual fighting that goes on behind the scenes. When we pray, things happen. When we pray, things happen. But it is God's to worry about those things. The Bible gives us some insight that we know exists. This is a very bold claim by Christians. This is the Bible's account of the origins of Satan. Again, we're only given a fragment of the story. It's tantalizing. I'd love to know the full story. But God in his wisdom has given us fragments so that we're aware of it, but not trying to take control of it. Then war broke out in heaven. Michael, who's a powerful angel, and his angels fought against the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. It isn't just a spiritual domain battle. He's been hurled down here. Do we see it? He was hurled to the earth and his angels with him. This is not a benign, simple world where things are just happening. C.S. Lewis is one of my favourite authors. I love some of the older authors. He wrote the Narnia series. And at the time that he wrote this book, it was hugely popular. Everybody wanted him to write sequels and prequels and everything else, Star Wars of its day, if you like. People loved it. He said it was one of the hardest things he ever wrote. The Screwtape Letters is basically a series of letters, or emails if you would like to think it in modern thing, between two people, two devils. And there's an older devil called Screwtape and his younger nephew, Wormwood. And the letters are backwards and forwards between these two devils, trying to discuss how to take control of their patient, who's just simply a human. So they're basically trying to get this human to believe, to not believe in God, to pull them away from God. And the letters are discussing the best ways to do this. And this is a little audio excerpt that I've got here. Is read by John Cleese, who's the author of Fawlty Towers. Not the author, sorry. He was the manager of the hotel in Fawlty Towers. And his voice is just brilliant in this. I love his cynical voice that plays on this. But this is just an excerpt from the Screwtape Letters.
I'd like first to read the preface written by C.S. Lewis at Magdalen College on July the 5th, 1941. I have no intention of explaining how the correspondence which I now offer to the public fell into my hands. There are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall about the devils. One is to disbelieve in their existence, the other is to believe and to feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. They themselves are equally pleased by both errors, and hail a materialist or a magician with the same delight. The sort of script which is used in this book can be very easily obtained by anyone who has once learned the knack, but ill-disposed or excitable people who might make a bad use of it shall not learn it from me. Readers are advised to remember that the devil is a liar. Not everything that Screwtape says should be assumed to be true, even from his own angle. I have made no attempt to identify any of the human beings mentioned in the letters, but I think it very unlikely that the portraits, say, of Father Spike or the patient's mother, are wholly just. There is wishful thinking in hell as well as on earth. In conclusion, I ought to add that no effort has been made to clear up the chronology of the letters. Number 17 appears to have been composed before rationing became serious. But in general, the diabolical method of dating seems to bear no relation to terrestrial time, and I have not attempted to reproduce it. The history of the European war, except insofar as it happens now and then to impinge upon the spiritual condition of one human being, was obviously of no interest to Screwtape. Letter 1. My dear Wormwood, I note what you say about guiding your patient's reading and taking care that he sees a good deal of his materialist friend. But are you not being a trifle naive? It sounds as if you suppose that argument was the way to keep him out of the enemy's clutches. Now, that might have been so if he had lived a few centuries earlier. At that time, the humans still knew pretty well when a thing was proved and when it was not, and if it was proved, they really believed it. They still connected thinking with doing, and were prepared to alter their way of life as the result of a chain of reasoning. But what with the weekly press and other such weapons, we have largely altered that. Your man has been accustomed, ever since he was a boy, to having a dozen incompatible philosophies dancing about together inside his head. He doesn't think of doctrines as primarily true or false, but as academic or practical, outworn or contemporary, conventional or ruthless. Jargon, not argument, is your best ally in keeping him from the church. Don't waste time trying to make him think that materialism is true. Make him think it is strong or stark or courageous. That it is the philosophy of the future. That's the sort of thing he cares about. The trouble about argument is that it moves the whole struggle onto the enemy's own ground. He can argue too, whereas in really practical propaganda of the kind I'm suggesting, he has been shown for centuries to be greatly the inferior of our father below. By the very act of arguing, you awake the patient's reason, and once it is awake, who can foresee the result? Even if a particular train of thought can be twisted so as to end in our favour, you will find that you have been strengthening in your patient the fatal habit of attending to universal issues and withdrawing his attention from the stream of immediate sense experiences. Now, your business is to fix his attention on the stream. Teach him to call it real life. And don't let him ask what he means by real.
So the main point there is just distract him with all the little distractions of the day. Don't get him thinking too deeply about things. Everything's kind of back to front in there. So when he talks about the enemy, he's talking about God. And when he talks about our father below, he's actually talking about the devil. So that's why it is quite difficult to get your head round. It's a kind of little taster of the sorts of way in which Satan attacks us. Even right at the beginning on the preface, he talks about the way that the Satan is quite happy and the devils are quite happy to distract us one way or the other, either to not believe in him at all, or to believe in him to an unhealthy level and not to apply our understandings right. God wants us to have a good balanced view as to who and what we are dealing with. Evil is very real. The enemy is active, very active and powerful. The Bible warns many times of this. But our God is greater. He knows what he's doing. The world feels out of control. It feels like it's all wild. It feels like nothing is happening according to God's plan. Think about Jesus right at the center of history. God knew what he was doing. Even before he went up to Jerusalem to be killed, he tells his disciples, "I will be taken up and I will be killed, and 3 days later I'll rise again." And they say, "What do you mean?" On hindsight, it's very easy for us with the scriptures to see it. God knows what he is doing. And just in case you're in doubt, here's the story of Job. And it gives us a little bit, again, of behind the scenes. It just gives us a glimpse in, just that we know what is going on. Then the Lord said to Satan, Satan made a request to God to test his servant Job. Job's very honourable to God, and Satan is asking to basically destroy everything about Job. And then he says, Job will then reject you. And God answers Satan. Lord said to Satan, "Very well, then. Everything he has is in your power. But on the man himself, do not lay a finger." So God is directing the exact measure to where Satan is allowed to go. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Satan is subservient to God. He's given a certain amount, but that is the limit. God is very specific here. And then the tragedies happen, and you literally have one servant after another on one day coming to Job and saying, your crops have been destroyed, your flock, he was a hugely wealthy man. His whole family got destroyed, his wife got destroyed. And four times the servants come up and they finish with, and I am the only one who's escaped to tell you. And Job's response is, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. That's Job's response. He trusts his God. But God is in control, and Job knows that. He knows that even though everything has fallen apart, he trusts God. Again, I'm not going to read these scriptures. It just gives us some insight into the spiritual domain. It talks about the abyss. And the main point I want to pull out here is actually in the second verse there in Luke 8. And Jesus is releasing a man from who's possessed by a demon. And the demon responds to Jesus through the man. And he says... Jesus asked him, what's your name? This is to the demon that's possessing the man. And the man responds, on behalf of the demon, Legion, he replies, because many demons had gone into him. And they begged Jesus repeatedly not to order them to go into the abyss. Now, it is quite a complex picture in the Bible of hell, abyss, and the lake of fire. The point here is that Jesus has the authority and the devils know it. They are begging him. We are told some of the things in the Bible about hell, the abyss, and the lake of fire. There's quite a chunk of it in Revelation. Revelation is a difficult book. It doesn't tell it so that we can fully understand it. It is there to help us understand that God is the one who is in control. It is God's great story. Our part is to look to him and see what part he has for us to play in that story. It is not our story to write. It is God's story. And we are the ones who take the part that God gives us. Here's an example of the part that 72 were given by Jesus. They were sent out into the land. Jesus gives them a special time. And this is quite unusual and quite unique. And they've just come back. And this is what the 72 say and what Jesus says in response to them. The 72 returned with joy and said, Lord, even the demons submit to us in your name. Jesus replied, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. I have given you authority to trample on snakes and scorpions and to overcome all the power of the enemy. Nothing will harm you. However, do not rejoice in that the spirits submit to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven. Jesus is worried about their eternal existence. Yes, they've had a great battle. Yes, they've put Satan down a notch. But Jesus is saying it's about you and your eternal life. That is the same story that is true today. Don't lose the focus. It is important to try and understand and grapple with the spiritual, but the ultimate issue is us and eternity and God, our relationship with God. So, putting into action. Let's be observant. Let's look and see how the enemy is attacking us. I'm going to actually take some time to listen to the rest of that. It's 3.5 hours, the Screwtape Letters. I'm just going to listen to it and see how that applies to my life and see what things I can learn from that. And then once we see the areas that we're struggling with, the ways in which the enemy is getting at us, pray for wisdom on how to pray and fight back. We can't do it in our own strength. We can't do it in our own wisdom. We can't do it in our own way. God knows how to do it. And keep on praising. The thing of worship that I said at the beginning. Even if you're mystified, lost, not knowing where you're going, praise. That's what Job did. Job lost everything. And yet he praised God. Keep praising till faith emerges victorious.
see.